Okay, so Christina Rossetti. And has everybody looked at the footnoted versions of the poems? Thank you, and yes, or thank you, and no? You go, no? And then yes, you print it in the bottom.
Yes,
very much.
One time.
You were here, yes?
1 year ago, so.
1 year ago. Yes, good. It's no time if you have to look up the words, but if you have the words given to you, there should be time. But anyway. Okay, so Christina's father was a political exile from Italy who taught at King's College. Hello. Photocopy. Okay, well, whatever. Her mother was Frances Polidori. Why does that name ring a bell? Sorry?
Polidori.
Yes, good, right. She was the sister of Byron's friend, Dr. Polidori, who famously wrote The Vampire, good. Her brothers, Daniel Gabriel Rossetti and William Michael Rossetti, were also poets. So there was poetry in the family. Daniel Gabriel being the most famous, above all, as a Pre-Raphaelite painter. He was, together with William Morris, the founder of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. And even though the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood as such did not last very long, only lasted a couple of years, they were lifelong friends and all the other type of people involved with the Pre-Raphaelites in a wider context, like William Morris. Have you heard of William Morris? William Morris? Who was that?
Architect.
Good. Yes, he was an architect and a designer and a novelist and a poet and all sorts of things and a socialist. But he was the intellectual motor, I suppose would be the word, behind what we call the art and crafts movement, which, as far as you're concerned, is Laura Astley. So all of those sort of lovely Victorian floral designs for curtains and wallpaper and all that sort of thing is sort of faux art and crafts movement. But basically the idea there being that you should turn work from being toil back into being work, into being creative, and a little bit sort of anti-industry. It's certainly anti-industry where industry destroys creativity, etc., etc. And Edward Burne Jones, do you know Edward Burne Jones? One of the great Pre-Raphaelite painters, although I think he was not actually officially a member of, I can't remember if he was officially a member of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, but lots of Arthurian medieval paintings which you will have seen were by Edward Burne Jones, etc., etc. So, on the one hand, Christina Rossetti is sort of typical Victorian young woman who doesn't go out of the house much. On the other hand, she is constantly being visited by her brother's friends, who are, to some extent, the intellectual elite of the country in the early to mid-Victorian period, basically the Pre-Raphaelites. Of course, the Pre-Raphaelites were very closely linked to John Ruskin, who is the great aesthetic theorist of the period. There is apparently, I have not seen it yet, I probably will one day, a biopic series called Romantics, rather confusingly, about the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. I don't know if it is good or bad because I have not seen it yet, but it exists if you are interested. Another sister, Maria, was an expert on Dante. Dante, the Italian poet, not Dante, her brother, and wrote scholarly books about Dante at a time when women did not write scholarly books. So it's quite a high level functioning family. The comments by people like William Morris and Edward Burne Jones when they came to visit the house was that Christina was witty and very intelligent, but somewhat shy and bad-tempered. So she was interesting. She was certainly the intellectual equal of these men, but a little bit difficult at times. She started writing poetry when she was very young and very prodigiously, like all of these people, for some reason. Her first volume of poems was published when she was 17. Her grandfather, I think her Italian grandfather, paid for her first volume of poems to be published. And she wrote more than 1,100. So we are at the opposite extreme of somebody like Thomas Gray. She is writing massive amounts of poetry and not doing very much else. Her poetry reflects a simple lyrical quality devoid of worldly experience. As I said, she didn't get out much. She didn't go into the East End to look for a kidnapped dog, etc., etc. So she was largely writing from a literary and intellectual experience rather than the experience of real life. The dominant theme of her poetry is frustration and the feeling that only death can bring relief. So fun, fun, fun. That is an exaggeration, as we will see in something like Winter My Secret. She can have a sense of humor. Her heaviest influence was John Keats. Everybody's influenced either by Keats or by Shelley. In 1849, when she was 19, she fell in love with the painter James Collinson, who was a Victorian with tendencies towards Pre-Raphaelites. He's not seen as the core group of Pre-Raphaelites. But the following year, he converted to Catholicism, and so she broke off the relationship. She was an Anglo-Catholic. So basically, Anglo-Catholics believe in everything in Catholicism except for the Pope. So we're talking about really, really minor differences in religion. We're not talking about somebody who is deeply Catholic deciding not to marry somebody who is a Muslim, for example, or something where there are serious differences of belief. This is almost difficult to believe from a modern perspective because there is really incredibly little difference. In fact, large parts of the Tractarian movement, which became the Oxford movement around Newman, I think he's called John Newman, became Catholics. But when Newman converted to Catholicism and became Cardinal Newman, became the head of the Catholic Church in Britain. So, I mean, as I say, the differences are really, really minor. It's not a reason to not marry somebody you're in love with. But anyway, that is her problem. One of her biggest pleasures was chess, but then she decided to give up playing chess because she decided she was too interested in winning. So we're talking about somebody who is really tightly wound and really sort of cannot let her hair down. Everything is taken incredibly seriously, which I think is one of the things, one of her problems in life, if you like, one of the restrictions she lives by. She never went to the theatre because she thought the theatre was sinful. The theatre at the time was pretty atrocious, so it doesn't really matter. But, I mean, of course, that means that she was missing out on Shakespeare and all the other things that were dominating the theatre. Even though it was not new theatre, it was old theatre. There was a lot of revival of Sheridan and Shakespeare and Goldsmith, and nothing that was particularly scandalous. So, again, that's a little bit sad. She prayed several times a day and memorized large sections of the Bible. Every good Victorian home, as I've told you, had their copy of Paradise Lost. Mrs. Beaton's cookbook, the complete works of William Shakespeare, and probably the complete works of William Wordsworth. So that was something that people would do. They would read large chunks of the Bible regularly and talk about it. Rossetti disassociated herself from the suffragette movement because she decided that women's rights and Christianity were at odds, were contradictory. Don't ask me why. I don't know where that comes from, but that was her conclusion. At the age of 60, when she was 30, she fell in love with Charles Bagot Cayley. But 5-6 years later, she broke this relationship off because he was not sufficiently interested in religion. And obviously, as we can see, she was. In 1862, she published Goblin Market and Other Poems, which includes Winter My Secret, Uphill, and After Death. So all of the poems by her that we studied were published in the same year and written in the three previous years. So what we actually see is a very specific chunk of her poetry, and her poetry is extensive. And she's writing basically the whole of her life, so be aware of that. In 1872, when she was 41, she fell ill with Graves' disease. I have no idea how you say Graves' disease in Spanish, but Graves' disease is a condition of the thyroid, of the thyroides, which become overactive and result in the neck swelling out and the eyes bulging. So a very unpleasant disease, which made her even more of a recluse because she was upset about her appearance. In 1894, she died of cancer. She had an operation for breast cancer in 1893, but there was metastasis. Her best known poem is In the Bleak Midwinter, I don't know why it says, but presumably that means before 1872. I wrote before 1972, which is obvious. That's a mistake in the notes. Anyway, I'll try and remember to correct that. Why is In the Bleak Midwinter her most famous poem? Because it has been set to music several times and was voted in 2008 Britain's favourite Christmas carol. As you know, we have songs like you have that we sing at Christmas, but whereas all of your songs are boomba, 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 and that sort of thing, the English carols are very sort of, oh, no, 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 no. And this is very much like that. It's very much sort of choral voices rather than boomba, boomba. We don't have this thing that you, that doesn't exist in Britain. So, as you can see, that explains a lot about British culture. We have no boomba. As I said, most people probably would not know that In the Bleak Midwinter was written by Christina Rossetti, but they would recognize the name immediately and be able probably to tell you a few of the lyrics as part of the whole sort of Dickensian Christmas experience, which British people seem to enjoy. Their only contact with religion is through their Dickensian Christmas. The big problem with Christina's poetry is that it is either extremely innocent, perhaps idiotically simple, or scandalously cynical and sexual for a Victorian lady. And of course, it cannot be both. You have to choose. And it is very, very difficult, unless you have an agenda, to choose. I mean, if you've made up your mind beforehand that everybody is Freudian and blah, 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 then obviously everything is about sex. But if you try to keep an open mind, it is incredibly difficult to weigh that up and decide. You know, there are phrases in something like Goblin Market where, you know, you think, right, well, that's it. It has to be about sex. But other parts of the poem, not. You see her life story, and that doesn't really fit. So it is incredibly difficult, and I personally do not come to a particular conclusion about that. I really, really don't know. But one of the aspects of great poetry, which is often something that makes literary critics very nervous, is that ambivalence is an important aspect of poetry, and people can be producing ambivalence on purpose. Again, the stream of ambivalence in some of these poems is like, you know, wow, can this woman really be doing this intentionally or not? But ambivalence is an important aspect of poetry. If you're interested in that, you should read Epsom's study on ambivalence, written in 1936, if I remember correctly. And this would be an example of William Epsom's sixth type of ambivalence, which the book is called Seven Types of Ambiguity. So, if you're interested in that. Anyway, in the sixth type, where something appears to contain a contradiction and the reader has to find the interpretation, if it's really there. Until 1980, Rossetti was valued for the simplicity and delicacy of her language. And then subsequently, she was rediscovered by feminist readings, who tend to find her infinitely subtle. She certainly is much more interesting than she was given credit for before the 1980s. Some of the levels of interpretation are questionable, but that is the case with any type of literary criticism. If literature was 2 + 2 = 4, then it wouldn't be interesting. The danger, of course, is to know the limits of interpretation and to avoid overreading. Literary critics hate silence, hate not knowing. But we will revisit the subject when we get to Winter, My Secrets. Her most famous poem as poem rather than as Christmas carol is Goblin Markets. Although Christina herself declared that Goblin Market was not symbolic or allegorical, her disclaimer has never been accepted, and interpretations of the hidden or secret meaning have been made from the earliest reviews. Goblin Market is believed to have influenced Alice in Wonderland, which appeared 3 years later, another work which is endlessly interpreted without anybody coming to any definitive conclusion. Well, they come to a definitive conclusion for themselves, but nobody else accepts their definitive conclusion. So there are lots of definitive conclusions about what it really means. Violence and eroticism of language linger longer than the moral ending in the reader's mind. Some key words, if we like, the center of the semantic field, apart from fruit, is consumption and sister. Consumption, of course, has two meanings, especially if you are a Victorian. Consumption means demand in the market economy. Bless you, Gesundheit. And consumption also means tuberculosis, right. Laura's reduced state is identical to a consumptive trance. We the way that Laura's illness is described could be exactly the same as the description of consumption. Remember, the consumption was particularly sexy for the Victorians because it was associated with vampirism, and it made you look pale white, like you're made out of marble, like a medieval saint or something, and then you cough up blood. There could be that resonance there about making the relationship between consumption and consumption. Sisters is the other important concept. Sisters can mean female siblings or can mean members of a lay order. So basically nuns without being proper nuns. And of course sister can also refer to female solidarity. And there's all sorts of ideas of those three things resonating in this work. Remember, at the time that Christina wrote Goblin Market, she was working as a lay sister. You understand lay sister? Literally, hermana laica. So, yeah. So somebody who does volunteer work as a nun from 9 to 5, sort of thing, and then goes home and lives their life. So that sort of works like a nun, helping people who need help, but without actually going into taking holy orders, etc. Basically, Anglicanism doesn't really have nuns or monks. So when you have monks and nuns in Britain, they are Catholics, and she is this much different from being a Catholic. So again, she is the closest you can get to being a nun as an Anglican is being a lay sister.
But are there lay sisters?
Sorry?
Is it normal? Were there
normal
lay sisters?
Relatively, yes. I mean, amongst the high church, amongst the Anglo-Catholics, the more sort of Protestant puritanical view was that you should be good to other people without putting a title on it, etc., etc. That's just part of your normal life sort of thing, etc. They're just different views of how you go about these things. These things are organized into congregations, and her particular organization was involved in reforming fallen women, in inverted commas. So this was a place where ex-prostitutes could go. They could get out of that lifestyle, or whatever we want to call it, and learn a useful skill, an honest trade like sewing or something like that, which of course would not produce the same amount of money. In this occasion, the idea was to teach them useful skills and then to reinsert them into society as servants. So they would have recommendations from respectable people like Christina Rossetti, be able to go and become servants and live happily ever after as servants. Other types of organizations like this, one of the organizations that was funded by Dickens, took in these women, gave them a few skills and sent them to Australia, where they would not cause any problems. And of course, Australia was a country at the time with a horrendous imbalance, male-female, so they would be taken out of prostitution, and they would be a long way from anybody who'd known about their previous lives, and they would become honest wives in Australia, etc., etc. All of which is hideously paternalistic, probably doesn't reach being misogynistic, but anyway, certainly paternalistic. But this is where, as far as the Victorians go in terms of understanding sexual oppression and sexual hierarchy and all of this type of thing. D.M.R. Bentley suggests that Christina may have read her poem aloud to the women confined in the home for fallen women in which she served as a volunteer until 1870. So you can see her, you can imagine her reading aloud, suck and suck and suck some more, all of these rather strange, bizarre phrases that there are in Goblin Market to these ex-prostitutes, and these ex-prostitutes understanding that we're simply talking about goblins and food, etc., etc. Bizarre, situation. There is no evidence that I've seen for this. This is just something that D.M.R. Bentley believes may have happened. So typically in this type of institution, like in the, what were they called? The Mediocre Sisters, by Los Pobres, workhouses. Like in the workhouses, typically people are separated by sex, obviously in this case, and are not allowed to talk during meals. So the idea is that you sit during a meal, a little bit like in a medieval monastery, and you listen to somebody reading a instructive, edifying piece of literature of one sort or the other, reading from the Bible, reading from the Book of Common Prayer, or reading from Goblin Market, perhaps. Joseph Bristow says, the idea of sisterhood, which is in many ways the focus of Goblin Market, brings together a range of familial and religious meanings that have a special amplitude for a Victorian writer such as Rossetti in ways that may be obscure to modern readers, but does not elaborate much on that. Whether we interpret Laura and Lizzie as biological sisters or symbolic sisters determines whether their relationship is potentially incestuous or simply lesbian. Again, concepts which are difficult for Victorian ladies. The idea that there is sex involved in this poem. Who has read Goblin Market at least once? Because otherwise you have no idea what I'm talking about. You must have read it the last year. Yeah, okay. Because otherwise it's quite difficult to have an opinion about what I'm talking about, but anyway. This is pretty self-evident that there is sex in this poem. If you accept the, I don't know how you pronounce this, it's Ramblusian, I suppose, Ramblusian or something, confusion of physical functions. Eating overlaps with sex, spitting out with childbirth. So there is a long tradition of particular types of eating, especially devouring, eating in a way which is out of control, being associated with sex, from Fielding's Tom Jones to his Coy Mistress by Marvel, to all sorts of things by Rambles, as we say in English, as we don't say in English. So we have to decide whether the description of the sisters' relationship is astonishingly innocent or shockingly explicit. It cannot be both. One question is, who is Jenny? Who's Jenny? So there is a young woman who has accepted goblin fruit previously and who has died. Now, how do I know that she is called Jenny and not Jeannie? J-E-A-N-I-E, J-E-A-N-I-E, is pronounced Jeannie in the American sitcom about a witch. I think that's not directly in Brujada. In Brujada is bewitched. Jeannie was an imitation of in Brujada, but it doesn't matter. That is called Jeannie, okay? So why do I call this woman Jenny? Because it rhymes with many in the poem. So we know that she wanted to, it can be pronounced either way, we know that she wanted to rhyme it with Jenny. And if we do rhyme it with Jenny, if we do take her name as Jenny, then that's interesting, because a poet called Dante Gabriel Rossetti, her brother, wrote a poem called Jenny, which is a dramatic monologue of a student looking at the sleeping body of a prostitute he has just slept with, and is thinking in his mind about how this young woman's experience is, or life story is very, very similar to that of his cousin, who's called, I can't remember the name of the cousin. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. Very similar to the story of his cousin. So, you know, a tiny mistake in a young woman's life is the difference from being a young lady to being a prostitute. And it's a quite a progressive poem, basically suggesting that it is ridiculous the way that Victorians deal with young women. And there is a significant part of society which takes this point of view. As I mentioned to you, I think a couple of weeks ago, there was a whole genre of painting of women, young women who had been drowned in the Thames because they had become pregnant, and the only solution to their pregnancy was to throw themselves into the Thames, which was disgusting at the time and very cold as well, and to drown themselves. And so this genre of painting by people like Lord Leighton and Frederick Lee and people like that show these the bodies of these dead young women like saints, basically, on the banks of the Thames, and basically an attempt to change people's attitudes socially. So we have to decide if that's just a coincidence, or is the fact that she is called Jenny and she is a fallen woman in this sense is relevant. Prostitutes, of course, have a very special place in Victorian society, apart from being ubiquitous. The prostitute can be seen as the transgressor of the separate spheres model of society, right? The idea that ladies in their private sphere, men in the public sphere, prostitutes are women who are in the public sphere. And she threatens the private bliss of the angel of the home, in a very real sense, not just because she may be a competitor providing sex, but because, as in the case of Mrs. Beaton, as in the case of thousands and thousands of Victorian ladies, she would be, the husband would be a conduit for syphilis, or there was massive epidemic, gonorrhea, and all sorts of other STDs. She symbolizes objectification by offering herself for consumption. So again, that takes us back to the whole idea of consumption. She is consumed, as it were. Laura, of course, buys the goblin fruit with part of herself, a lock of her hair. And this could be a symbolic reference to that most famous Victorian poem, sorry, not Victorian, early modern poem, Pope's The Rape of the Lock. According to Sandra Gilbert and Susan Dunbar, who you know and love, wicked men offer Laura forbidden fruits, a garden of sensual delights, in exchange for her golden treasure that, like any young girl, she keeps in her purse, in inverted commas, or for permission to, in inverted commas, rape a lock of her hair. Once she has lost her virginity, however, she is literally valueless and therefore not worth even further seduction. A simple allegory of callous seduction, in other words. That is a legitimate interpretation. I don't think that is definitive. It is nearly as definitive as Gilbert and Dunbar suggest. Cora Kaplan, of course, has a different opinion, because Cora Kaplan always has a different opinion from Gilbert. She says, Goblin Market undoubtedly remains an exploration of a woman's sexual fantasy, which includes suggestions of masochism, homoeroticism, rape, and incest. I am perfectly happy with that, except for the word undoubtedly. Undoubtedly, I think there's far too much going on to say that that is undoubtedly. But it is true, and this says nothing about Christina Rossetti's intentions, it is true that in 1973, the magazine Playboy produced published Goblin Market with a series of mildly erotic illustrations. And so, I mean, yeah, it was perfectly, it fitted perfectly with Playboy's raison d'etre, if you like, that type of interpretation. Now, I have a problem with that because obviously in Victorian terms, losing virginity reduces one's value in the marriage market, but it doesn't cause your progressive death. It's not, there is some stretch of distance between saying that having extramarital sex is something which is bad for your social status in Victorian England and saying that it's something that will kill you unless there are mitigating circumstances. So there is some type of problem there. And so thinking about this, the 2 days ago, I suddenly thought about the idiotic but prevalent situation of the virgin cleansing myth. Do you know what I'm talking about? Unfortunately, in Africa, there is a wide-held belief that if you have sex with a virgin, it can cure you of AIDS. Of course, a silly African idea, except for the fact that this is a European idea. It did not originate in Africa. So I mean, there is a hideous amount of rape of minors, of physically and psychologically disadvantaged people in Africa for this reason. But this started, the virgin cleansing myth actually originated in the 16th century, Wikipedia tells me, and was very prevalent specifically in the Victorian period. So, if you understand the idea that virgins are particularly at risk from people who have sexually transmitted diseases, and you have this situation of syphilis and gonorrhea, which are at epidemic proportions, then that makes much more sense according to what happens in this poem. Hannah Blank says the origin of the virgin cleansing myth is unknown, but Hannah Blank says that the idea may have evolved from Christian legends of virgin martyrs, where purity served as a form of protection in battling demons, etc. So, I mean, it's all very idiotic and medieval, but it was very popular at the time and exists then. That would also, I think, explain the idea of these deformed goblins. One of the aspects, certainly, of the first wave of syphilis was that it tended to deform people's faces. Their noses fell off and their ears fell off and things like that. So Lizzie identifies the problem as residing in the consumption of the fruit. She can redeem her sister by beating the goblins at their own game. There is, of course, no magic way of redeeming STDs. So the comparison, if you like, breaks down there, but there is some of the idea that suggestion possibly is that non-sexual love between sisters, define as you like sisters, is a type of remedy to this type of value system. Lizzie's lesson is transmitted to subsequent young women through Rossetti's poem. So, if you like, the love of Lizzie may not be a cure to Laura's problem in the real world, but it can be a remedy to this problem in the real world, in the sense that it provides a warning. If that is the case, then one way of warning young women about the dangers of men who are specifically interested in having sex with them because they are virgins, is to dress it all up as goblins, etc. You don't want to be talking to young women and children in terms that are explicitly sexual, so you describe it in terms that are goblins and fantastical, but suggest the same sort of fear. We'll come to that. That's theory number 37. I'm joking, but it's on the list. We have to ask, of course, if Lizzie is a significant name. Why might Lizzie be a significant name? Lizzie Elizabeth Siddle was a Pre-Raphaelite painter. Interest has been shown in her since until recently. She is actually quite an interesting painter. The Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood were very much a brotherhood, and it was all about men. But although a number of the women around the circle were painting sometimes things which were much more interesting than what the men were painting, but that's another question. And she was Dante Gabriel Rossetti's muse. So you know the famous painting of a red-headed woman in green, which is, so I think it's meant to be some sort of ecstasy, religious ecstasy, I can't remember. But anyway, if you look up Dante Gabriel Rossetti on Google Images, the first thing you will see probably is this image. It's called something like, it's related to Dante, it's called something like Laura Mia or Beatrice Mia or something like that. No? What's it called? Beatrice? Beatrice? No? Yes? No? Found it? What found it? Oh, not very good at searching on Google. No? No? Oh, come on, there must be the first. No, in the bottom corner. No. In the bottom. I don't want to knock everything over. Yes, we'll get the name. What is the name? Beata Beatrix. Okay, fine. Beata Beatrix. Beatrice, if it's in Italian. Yeah? That is Elizabeth Siddle, and she was very much part of the family. She got consumption, like everybody. Anybody who considered themselves artistic should get consumption. And she was an addict to drumroll. She was an addict to drumroll. Laudanum, of course. She eventually died of either suicide or an overdose. It's not clear, but she died of taking too much laudanum. She died the year after, Goblin Market was published, but she was not dead when it was written. So it's not about her death, but it could be. The name could be significant. It's a significant name in the family. It's somebody who is addicted to laudanum. Dante Gabriel Rossetti treated her pretty awfully. Never, ever, ever marry an artist. Terrible people. Like Picasso, people like that. Awful. But, of course, once she was dead, he was hugely regretful, like any good artist, like Thomas Hardy, for example, another one. Do you know the story? Well, because he was so sad about her death, he buried the only copy he had of his last couple of years' worth of poems with her, in the tomb with her. And then she was buried, etc., etc. And then he suddenly realized that he was suffering from writer's block and he could not think of any more poems. So he aguantó a couple of years and then decided to dug her up, and to take the book of his poetry out of her hands. She had the last laugh because while in the grave, her hair had grown, basically had filled her coffin with this long red hair. And so he opened the coffin to grab the book and was horrified by this image of all these red hairs that were shining out at him. He also died half mad, having taken lots of laudanum as well. So that's another happy story. But anyway, there you go. That's a little bit later. So maybe the name Lizzie is important. It's not just the relationship with Elizabeth. Elizabeth Siddle was known in the family by everybody as Lizzie. And she was very much part of the family and somebody that Christina Rossetti saw on a daily basis. And somebody who she probably would have considered a sister in that sort of sense. So, there is potentially a feminist idea behind this. Is this a sort of fantasy, feminine idol, at least at the end of the poem? There are mothers, there are daughters, there are sisters, but there are no men. There are only goblins. That could be one of the things being, suggested here. Theory number 48. What we have in this poem is a fall and a redemption. We've seen that somewhere before. Yes, Christianity. So this could be seen as a feminized version of the Bible. Somebody eats some fruit, Eve, Adam and Eve, or Laura, and somebody else sacrifices themselves in a Christ-like way, Christ's crucifixion, Lizzie getting covered in fruit. Not quite the same thing, but that could be symbolically what is happening here. To what extent can we say that Lizzie is Christ-like? Well, she does say, eat me, drink me, love me. Eat me, drink me, love me sounds incredibly sexual to somebody who is cynical in the 21st century. But of course, if you are Victorian and very religious, eat me, drink me, love me sounds like transubstantiation. Sounds like the body and blood of Christ becoming the Eucharist. What I don't know, you're going to ask me, do Anglo-Catholics believe in transubstantiation? And the truth is, I don't know. Not sure about that. But certainly, they would be much closer to transubstantiation than most Anglicans and most Protestants, who of course understand this is my body as a metaphor rather than as literal. The problem, of course, is that in Hebrew, if you wanted to metaphorically say, this is like my body, this is like my blood, you just say, this is my body, this is my blood, and the metaphor or the simile is implicit. So one of the problems of the Hebrew translation that has caused about 30 million people to be killed in Europe in the 16th and 17th century. Wonderful. Anyway. Who says that translation is not important? Again, if we are pushing this metaphor a little bit, Glen, what's a Glen? A valley, yes, a Scottish valley. So, a Glen could be a valley. If we're talking about valleys, we could be talking about the Valley of Death. There could be a biblical reference there. There are direct biblical references in this poem. One of the things that Victorians did, apart from reading little bits of their Bible daily, was to make notes in the margin. That would seem to be almost sacrilegious to us today, but because the Protestant idea, if you like, was very much the idea that you have to be reading the Bible yourself and interpreting it and going there directly rather than listening to some bachelor priest telling you what the Bible means because somehow he is closer to God. That is not the Protestant or the Anglican view of things. And so it is very normal for somebody who is Protestant or Anglican to be making notes in their Bible. And we have Christina Rossetti's Bible, and we have her notes. And there is a clear link from her notes between Revelation 18:11-17 and this poem. Can anybody quote me Revelation 18:11-17? And they told me it was a Catholic country. Nobody knows anything about the Bible. Okay. Revelation 18:14 says, "And the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee, and all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more at all." Which basically describes Laura's situation after taking the fruit. And we have a little note in the margin here in Christina's Bible. And the next verse, or the next three verses, carry on by saying, talk about the desolation of Babylon, Babylon has always been linked, has always been a link between commerce, decadence, and sexual indulgences. Yeah? Babylon, there's always some idea of sort of sexual decadence back behind there. If you think of Griffiths' film Intolerance, yeah? Babylon's all about sort of naked women dancing and all that sort of thing. There are, of course, other interpretations. Why not? There may be a reference to Catullus in his poem 55, lines 18 and 19. He says, "Sin linguam cause tenes in ore, fructus priotes amoris omnes." In other words, if you keep your tongue shut within your mouth, you will waste all the fruits of love. But it's probably completely irrelevant. That's up to you. Herbert Tucker says that Goblin Market as a critique of the rise of advertising in Victorian consumer society. So, it's all about advertising. Great. Okay? There is obviously a more realistic connection, as we've seen, with drug abuse. The importation of opium, which is where you get laudanum from, quadrupled between 1830 and 1860. There is, of course, the idea of the terrible British imperialists with the opium war in China, but the opium was also affecting British society significantly at the time as well, without excusing any type of imperialism. I'm not going to say that was all right. I'm just saying it was a problem in both countries. Blah, blah, blah. Goblin Market, another theory, is that Goblin Market may be related to eating disorders. Now, anorexia nervosa was not named until 1874, I believe. But obviously, that the fact of naming doesn't mean it didn't exist beforehand. It existed perfectly well beforehand, just didn't have a name. And what we have is somebody who binges, who eats too much fruit in this case, and then nearly starves herself to death. And the suggestion might be that the solution to eating disorders is not guilt or this, that, or the other, it's love, which is a relatively intelligent solution, given the sort of solutions we've been given at the time to all sorts of problems. It could be about an eating disorder. Who knows? So that is Goblin Market. Fun for all the family. Uphill. that you have there. What is the form of this poem? If you are the internet generation, you would probably say FAQ. You would probably say frequently asked questions. But if you are from a more traditional generation, you would say this is in the form of a catechesis. This is in a catechism. This is in the form of questions and answers that you would find in a catechism. And certainly the religious context rather than the internet context would suggest that it is much more related to a catechism. The pace of the poem is constant, suggesting progress on the uphill roads. The poem is a familiar theme of rest and relaxation offered by heaven after the hard journey of life. The idea that life is a journey, like life is a river, blah, 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 is a pretty established one. We have examples in George Herbert's religious poetry. George Herbert was, until the 1960s, the most famous metaphysical poet. But because he wrote almost exclusively religious poetry, is much less exciting than John Donne's poetry, his cachet has fallen continuously since 1960, and John Donne and Andrew Marvell's poetry has risen. But it also has quite a lot to do with Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, another book which every self-respecting English person would have read at the time. In The Pilgrimage by George Herbert, George Herbert says, "I travelled on, seeing the hill where lay my expectation. A long and weary way it was." Same sort of idea. However, the answers given by Rossetti's second speaker are rather evasive, and the conclusion seems almost nihilistic. Death for the Christian means sleep, not a feast, not eternal bliss, sleep. Great. Uphill can be read as a bitterly ironic comment on life. Basically, very similar to the American expression, life's a bitch and then you die, if you like. It could be a way of understanding the poem. That expression was first used, it was first written down in the Washington Post in 1982, by the way. It's interesting. It is anonymous. Christina was surrounded by people who suffered under their agnosticism, stroke atheism, their loss of belief. One such person was William Rossetti, her brother, who was keenly aware, like Carlyle, that it was, or Tennyson, that it was more and more difficult to believe in a Christian God, but realized that with nothing to replace the Christian God, apart from Arthurian legends, nationalism, and idiocy, it wasn't a very good substitute for believing. But one thing is to want to believe, and the other thing, of course, is to believe. So the poem is built around three well-worn metaphors. Life is a road, an uphill struggle. Life in a day, with morning, youth, noon, maturity, and dusk, old age, with night being death. And death is sleep. Our little life is rounded with a sleep, as Shakespeare said in The Tempest, or the big sleep as Hamlet. What's the first name? Denzel Hamlet. Desnel Hamlet said in his noir novel. God, what's it called in Spanish? With the big stick? Sueño eterno, yeah. That, of course, the idea of equating death with sleep is acceptable to most atheists. Yeah, most atheists would think that probably the best metaphor that we can find for death would be sleep, a situation where you lose control of your consciousness and you disappear as a thinking entity. Fine. That, how could we have this enormously religious woman who will not play chess because it's not good for her religion, who will not go to plays because it's not good for her religion, who will reads the Bible every day, who spends her lunchtime reading to prostitutes? How could a woman like that be saying this? And the answer, which I'm really, really surprised you haven't come up with, is psychopanicism. Why didn't you say psychopanicism? What is psychopanicism? No? Awesome. Waiting for someone to look it up on the internet and then write their answer. Psychopanicism is a concept which comes from the Anabaptists, curiously, because Christina Rossetti was at the other extreme of Protestantism from the Anabaptists, but she believed in psychopanicism, which is popularly known as soul sleep. It's much easier to understand as soul sleep. For believers in psychopanicists, when virtuous people die, they go to sleep until the last judgment, and then they wake up. But what you have for that intervening period, however long that intervening period is sleep. And so this poem makes sense from that point of view, and we know that Christina Rossetti was a fan of this idea. Ultimately, in any case, whether this poem is about doubt or certainty depends on your reading of speaker B. Speaker A is anxious and doubtful. Speaker B has all the answers. As someone who has experienced death, Christ or God, he, she certainly is justified. Yeah? So, if this is somebody who is omniscient, who knows the answers really, then it's just, yeah, no, that's it, and those are the definitive answers. If, however, speaker B is the voice of a living Christian who has an act of faith, believes these things, we're no nearer to definitive answers. We just have somebody's faith beside somebody else's doubt, and it doesn't actually help us very much, because ultimately one person who is living and has never experienced death knows as much about death as another person. They can choose to believe or choose not to believe, if you like, but that does not take us closer to truth. Epistemologically, I'm talking. Epistemologically, I'm in diablo. Right. Although Rossetti was devoted to her Anglican faith throughout her lifetime, she did question her beliefs from time to time. In the 1850s, she suffered a religious crisis, which provided the material for her later devotional poems. So she wrote poetry after she had got over her religious crisis, but the fact that she had a religious crisis allowed her to write religious poetry which took into account such things. Doubt was a normal part of Rossetti's thought process, and guided her spiritual pursuit as well as her writing. By the way, another little anecdote. I know you like the little anecdotes. On the 29th of October, 1876, a Dutchman preached a sermon at Richmond Methodist Church. In it, he misquoted uphill, saying, "Does the road go uphill all the way? Will the journey take all day long?" Clearly quoting from uphill, even though he gets it wrong. The Dutchman eventually gave up preaching and dedicated his life to painting. Vincent van Gogh. There you have Vincent van Gogh in the same orbit as Christina Rossetti. After death. After death is a Petrarchan sonnet, basically. What does a Petrarchan sonnet, what expectations does the form of a Petrarchan sonnet throw up? In a more general sense, what do you expect if somebody says, "Toma, Petrarchan sonnet," what do you expect?
No.
A love sonnet, yes. The form of Petrarchan sonnet is intimately associated with love poetry. So, there are those expectations being created by the poetic form. After death, what could that be? I mean, there's a literal sense of after death. So we have perhaps the idea of love after death, that sort of thing. Is there any type of wordplay here, possibly? After birth? What is after birth? After birth is all of the sort of unpleasant liquid things that comes out with the baby. And sometimes I think we're in childbirth, there's a special type of massaging to get it all out. There is the possible resonance of the idea. What is that called in Spanish, by the way? Well, yeah, placenta, but is there not a, and the placenta is the whole time, but the los fluidos, that is after. So there's a possible resonance of sort of rather unpleasant after effects related to this significant moment in a life. Right. In this poem, a ghost recalls the man she loved, who is filled with pity, gazing at her corpse and weeping. There is disillusionment in the person's on the person's part. Her friend did not touch the shroud, nor raise the folds that hid my face, or take my hand in his, or ruffle the smooth pillow of my head. So, there is a certain potential disquiet about physical contact with the corpse, which could reflect a certain distance, certain disquiet about physical contact with the real person, the living person also, potentially. In short, he exhibits no commitment, even in the context of death. It's not what he does, it's what he fails to do. He fails to treat the dead body, the cadaver, with affection, if you like, by doing the sort of things that one would do to make the body more comfortable. Obviously, it's on a logical level, it's stupid to fluff up a pillow so that a corpse is more comfortable. But it's that type of over-rationalism which probably she is relating to here. The idea that it doesn't matter what is stupid, the point is to express your emotions rather than not express your emotions. So again, we're probably back with Victorian stiff upper lips. Who is she? Who is the ghost? Who is the speaker? We have a dramatic monologue. Who is the speaker? No, there's not necessarily the poet. It can't be the poet because the poet's not dead. she is creating a persona that has, so it has to be a dramatic monologue because she can't, literally she cannot be dead if she's writing a poem as a ghost. Who is she? Tell me something about her. He says poor child. Right, good. So she's a child? Why not?
She doesn't speak like a child.
In what way does she not speak like a child? Could a child not be disappointed about not being loved enough? I don't see why a child can't be disappointed about. Why is it not a child? Sorry? Yeah, but you can love a child or not love a child. No. He pitied me, and very sweet it is to know he still is warm, though I am cold. How would you describe the sentiments described in that line? He pitied me, and very sweet it is to know he still is warm, though I am cold. You have an exam. Passing this course depends on you being able to identify the type of sentence involved in, and very sweet it is to know he is still, so he still is warm, though I am cold. How would you describe it? Otherwise you have to repeat the entire course. Talk to me.
Ophelia.
But how would you describe, you're studying literature, you are studying language, how would you describe the sentiment expressed in that bloody line? Talk to me on the internet. Don't disappear. Tell me on the internet. What is the sentiment being described there? Sorry? So I should take this literally. This is somebody who thinks, literally, it is very sweet. Qué bonito. Qué bonito que él sigue caliente mientras yo estoy frío. It's irony. It's irony. It's sardonic irony. It's bordering on sarcasm. Children do not use irony. The reason I cannot relate to children is that everything I say, because I'm British, is ironic. And children don't understand irony. I spend my life, whenever we have children close, my wife's always saying, it's a child, doesn't understand irony. But children do not use irony and do not understand irony. So what we have here is the typical situation, very typical in Victorian times, Donald Trump, of a man marrying a woman who is very, is massively younger than him and has died young, you could imagine, childbirth, consumption, syphilis, whatever. A woman who has died young and he is much older and he related to her as a child. She is decorative. She is, to some extent, a trophy wife. Yeah? He doesn't really seem to want to touch her. There's not a real relationship going on here. There's somebody who he has bought a nice looking pet, like he might have a very nice spaniel, we all have spaniels, or whatever, and this is something to decorate his home with. And now she's died, and it makes him sad. But his sadness is not the same as love. He is sad for himself. He's not sad for her, he's sad for himself. She is an object who is no longer part of his collection, and he has to get rid of. It's very sad for him. So we have a non-relationship here, and somebody who becomes fully aware of the non-relationship when she has died, and she is expressing herself after death, where she probably hasn't been able to express herself in life. But of course, this is a solipsistic voice. She can express herself now, but nobody can hear what she's saying. So there seems to be a certain amount of bitterness in this poem. It's a little bit like King Lear's attitude towards Cordelia, if she ever had a soft and gentle voice, etc., etc. The fact that he only realizes her value when she is a dead body. One potentially bad milky type question, but perfectly legitimate question for your exam, would be to compare the attitude of the male or the male-female relationship in My Last Duchess and After Death. So, think through it and think about the relationship. And if you want, write something, put it on the internet, we can talk about it, we can exchange notes about it, but you have to participate as well, not just me. Okay? blah, 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 blah. So, Christina Rossetti, no fun at parties, I said. But she can be fun at parties, because we do have Winter, My Secret. In Goblin Market, Rossetti highlights the dangers of curiosity when she suggests that it was Laura's own curiosity that caused her downfall. Rossetti warns her readers against curiosity, which she perceives as a sin, and contrasts with obedience. Religion's always better at obedience than curiosity. That, of course, is the meaning of Islam, is subservience, is obedience. Is uphill about curiosity, perhaps? If so, is it condemned there? You have to answer the question. Isabel Armstrong focuses on the mask in the second verse, which is both disguise and representation. So she goes on. By using a mask, a woman writer is in control of her objectification and at the same time anticipates the strategy of objectifying women by being beforehand with it and circumventing masculine representation. This is the theme of Christina Rossetti's poem about masking, Winter, My Secret. And my only answer to that is perhaps. But before you take that necessarily as anything definitive, I think it is important to remember the name that Christina Rossetti gave to this poem before her brother Dante suggested Winter, My Secret. Winter, My Secret is a very good name for the poem. Her first name for the poem was Nonsense, Tonterias. And so, and I think that is a very helpful way to end the tutorial, because it does, again, teach us to be careful about reading too much into any of the poems of Christina Rossetti, into any poem that you like, but especially with Christina Rossetti. This poem, I think, in its tone, is one of having a bit of fun. And if we take it with the title of Nonsense, which is how she first wrote it, having a bit, it is just having a bit of fun. So to see it as about feminine objectification, this, that, and the other, or to interpret winter as somehow related to the Crimea, the Crimean War, or something, is probably taking it a little bit too far. Although perfectly justifiable in the sense that any interpretation is justifiable. Go home. It was suggested to me before the class that we should possibly have a drink at 10 o'clock next Wednesday. So I am perfectly up for that if you are. If you are unable to do that because you have to catch a train or a bus or whatever, don't worry, I will certainly not take it personally, but I will suggest to my other class also to go and have something to drink at 10 o'clock on Wednesday, our last class. There you go. Your last class ever, no? And in this, if you pass, yes, but you will pass. So that's all right. But you.